Hello and welcome everybody to another episode of 1000 Years of Beer, the podcast from the world's oldest brewery. As always, we are welcoming you as your hosts, Anton and me, Matthias.
Hello everybody out there. Thank you for listening in once again. As you know, in every season, we talk about a certain country, a certain important country to us, which is the Netherlands today.
The Netherlands. Correct. One neighbor country of Germany. And so we invited today from our general importer in the Netherlands, the beer ambassador of the company and a beer legend in the Netherlands, Mr. Rick Kempen. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Matthias. Hello, Anton. It's very nice to be here.
We're very glad to have you. We haven't seen each other in quite some time, so it's always good to hear from you.
Thank God there is such a thing as a screen.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. I'm just closing my eyes and pretend I didn't see you yesterday. So thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This is your topic basically because you're the expert for this export country. I'm sorry. I'm gonna mix it up once more, probably. Expert and export. Yeah.
It is complicated, Anton.
It is complicated. So, Matthias, do you want to do a quick introduction from our side?
Yes, of course. So Rick and me, we know each other now for a little bit less than 6 years. So we met through our... working for Wine Stefana, Rick in the Netherlands, and I'm for Wine Stefan here. And we had at some point some kind of similar jobs in some ways, actually. Because Rick is the beer ambassador, beer trainer, and cultural and technical, trainer for Beer & Co. Beer & Co. is beer importing company in the Netherlands, specialized on craft beers and special beers. And Rick is there, the beer mastermind, to train, teach, and tell the stories of the brands, the beers, and how they are made. But also, Rick is a beer expert far beyond of his job at Beer & Co. He was once awarded as the best beer bartender in the Netherlands. And you can talk about that a little bit. And he got into beer many, many years ago, decades ago, I would say, and became a bartender at one of the most famous beer places in the Netherlands, became beer bartender of the year. He became judge at some of the most prestigious beer competitions worldwide, like the Beer World Cup. We're going to talk about that also in a minute, because that's where we regularly see us, actually. So Rick and me, we are not meeting a lot in Wein Stefan or actually in the Netherlands. We are meeting all over the world at different trade fairs or beer competitions or so on. So that's our meeting points. A couple of weeks ago, we saw ourselves in Las Vegas at the World Beer Cup in Vegas.
Which was awesome.
But final, also, Rick is an author of beer as kind of a journalist and book author. And maybe you can also tell a little bit about that.
I can tell you a lot about everything. But thank you so much for this huge introduction. I think the listeners may now have gotten the idea that my life is 24 hours about beer. You are correct. My life is 24 hours about beer. And the funny thing is, it started basically in a really peculiar way because, I'm way much older than probably most of the listeners and you two guys for sure. It may actually no longer be that the two of you combined are my age, but it is still pretty close to that. When I started to go to university back in 1987, I had a side job in this bar in Amsterdam, the Pilsner Club. When I started to work there as a student, the landlord of the bar, Teun, the fourth generation Teun van Veen of this legendary beer bar in downtown Amsterdam, He basically trained me for 1.5 day in tapping a world-class beer. The bar serves Heineken. It is actually the only place in the world where I take people to sample a glass of Heineken, because it is actually the only place in the world where I believe you drink a very, very, very decent glass of Heineken directly from the tap. The secret there is that this bar still has a very large cooling cell, like one of those big walk-in fridges you see in butcher shops. Mm-hmm. It is actually an old cooling room for an old butcher shop in Amsterdam. And it means that the taps are actually mounted into the wall of this cooling cell, which means that the length of the line from the keg to the tap is only 1.5 meters, meaning that half of your glass, in the Netherlands we use quarter liter glasses as our size of choice, contrary to what you call a kleintje bier, your half liter glasses. But half of that glass actually comes out of the keg, and it means you've got a world-class tapped pilsner there. Took him about 1.5 days to teach me how we wanted it, because it means that if you pour the Heineken in the Netherlands, we pour it in one go rather than multiple taps because of a different way of serving. And we have this habit of striking the foam head off when it is still overflowing from the glass. So to create a bit of a, how do I say, a bit of a mounted cup of foam on the glass. And then the bottom of the head should be exactly at where the middle line of the star of the Heineken logo is. If you create that, that would be a perfect draft. Took him 1.5 days to teach me how to do that, multiple times and times again. I'm pretty sure we spilled 50, 60, 70 liters of beer. The reason was, he said, if people come to the Pilsner Club, they expect a world-class beer, and they pay a little bit more for it. And if they see a glass of beer served this way, they should know instantly that everything here is tip-top. The coffee is good. The toasty is good. The Jenever is good. Everything is about great quality here. And that was really the first moment in life when I realized there was more to beer than just drinking and enjoying it. This was almost becoming a religious thing. I worked there for 8-9 years, I think. And when I left, I had already participated indeed in some beer tapping competitions. I then left to Café Hoppe in Amsterdam, a pretty famous bar dating back 350 years now, I suppose. And then the first time I participated for them again in this beer tapping competition, indeed, Matthias, I became the best beer tapper of the Netherlands. And that actually was a massive party that we celebrated in Hoppe. The brewery, again, connected to the Heineken conglomerate, was Amstel that we were actually serving there. They were so proud of this that they offered the bar a free tank of beer, which is 1,000 liters of beer, just to celebrate it with the customers. I think we connected that tank 4:30 in the afternoon, and by 6 o'clock we already started the new tank to start celebrating on our own expenses. You can imagine it was like a big beer bash. And I worked for another couple of years in Hoppe. Then I had met my currently ex-wife. She worked in the daytime only. I was working only in the evenings in Hoppe. Decided that was not the best thing for us. With the knowledge of today, I should have left it that way. But then again, here you go. That's life. And I changed my career to Beer & Co. Didn't want to leave the on-trade, but I didn't want to be working in the evenings anymore. And that's what I started to learn. There was so much more beer than just the lager that I'd known and grown up with. And much to my surprise, the guys working in the warehouse, when they had finished their job, they would not open up a bottle of lager or a can of lager. They would crack open a bottle of Westmalle Triple or the Koning or La Chouffe, beers I had heard of but never really drank. And since Beer & Co. was an independent import distribution company carrying around 1,100 different breweries and beers, I started to get interested in that, knowing that I had to be selling those. So in those days, we're talking the early 90s of the last century now, there weren't many books. There was no internet of the shape that we know it today. So if you wanted to learn about something, you had to go out and discover. I started out sampling all of the beers we were selling, great job that is. started to go visiting the breweries that we were working with and importing, and that's where my real interest in beer was started and initiated. And at that time, we're now talking 1998, we actually started working within the Bier & Co. company with this little brewery from Freising. And then the current export manager, Markus Englet, started a week after when I started with Bier & Co. He started with Bier & Co. I think the first time we met was in 1999. And that was my introduction to the wonderful world of Weinstephan. And ever since, I've been part of the family.
Indeed, you are 25 years now connected with Weinstephan as a business partner and friend, a true friend of the brand. I could glimpse into that a little bit when we had our After World Beer Cup dinner in Vegas a few weeks ago. Yep. Markus and Rick were talking the whole night about old stories from the last 25 years and from trade fairs they have been on and stuff like that. And I'm like, huge. This was huge because I said, you could both of you like write multiple books just for entertaining, not about teaching about beer, just entertaining the people about the stories you two experienced in the world of beer together, because this would be a great read, I guess.
But I guess that is still my main fascination about beer, besides the magic of the making. But the one thing that continues to amaze make me happy is the fact that beer brings people together. It sparks conversations. It builds friendships. We have this business relationship, Bier & Co. and Weinstephan, but it is truly unique that you can, you don't have to, but you can also develop these personal friendships and relationships. And you know what you were just describing, the scene in Vegas, that's when you get, when you put two old men and two glasses of beer at the same table, you get these endless recallings of, oh, how awesome was this, how great was that. But in the end of the day, you know, we don't even see each other that often, but I'm still very, very proud that I was invited to attend Marcus's 50th birthday, celebrated it with him, family and friends in Freising, and he actually came to my 25th anniversary celebrations of Bier & Co. You know, those are things that really go beyond the business relationship. And that essentially for me is what 1,000 years of beer is making it even extra special. It brings people together, it builds friendships, and it strengthens bonds.
Absolutely. And so you have been there from the beginning.
Of
creating the story of Weinstephan in the Netherlands. First steps? I mean,
not 1,000 years ago. Don't worry about it.
the beginning of Weinstephan in the Netherlands, because actually the Netherlands are also a big beer country, a big beer culture. You're a country that likes to drink beer, and so how was it for? With Heineken, one of the biggest breweries in the world, comes from the Netherlands. So I guess there would be some kind of competition. So how is it for the craft beers, but also for specialty beers? Like,
wow, these are 1,000 questions in a sentence, Matthias. Let's go back to the first one. How was it when Weinstephan came to the Netherlands? And I'm really happy that you say that the Netherlands is indeed a big beer drinking country. But you also mentioned we have a beer culture. This is very interesting, because many Dutch people would completely disagree with you. And the reason for that is that when Pilsner was discovered in the Czech city of Pilsen in 1842 and spread like wildfire over Europe and the world, because it was for the first time that people were drinking a beer of consistent quality that actually looked nice to drink and was indeed very refreshing, didn't taste sour or smoky and look muddy. It blew away a lot of local beers and breweries, because they couldn't keep up with this competition thing. And particularly in the Netherlands, it led to the total destruction of local beer styles. Like every country, the Netherlands had a tradition of brewing beers with local ingredients. Beer was not meant to travel. let's say 1.5 centuries ago. So you would drink your local beer with local ingredients. And basically you could always tell by simply tasting the beer just whereabouts in the world you were, because you were tasting the local ingredients. Pilsner in the Netherlands took such a flight that it destroyed all these beer styles. If you go back into history and see that in the year 1900, this Amsterdam-based brewery, the Crown Falcon, the Gekroonde Valk, was the largest brewery in the Netherlands, and the beer they were most famous for was their stout. Vollenhoven Stout was the largest beer in the Netherlands in the year 1900, and by the year of 1949, it went bankrupt. And by then, like you were seeing in other European countries and even worldwide, consolidation was taking place. All the smaller breweries were bought up by the larger ones, and essentially the big lager breweries won the competition in the Netherlands. And by the year 1970, there was only one brewery in the Netherlands not making a lager, and it was the Phoenix Brewery from Amersfoort. But even by the 1980s, when I started to go work in the Pilsner Club, you only had 16 breweries left. And let's recap quickly to the year 1900, when the Crown Falcon was the largest one in the Netherlands. You had 336 breweries in the Netherlands. So with that, wow, it was a total bloodbath. Out of those 18 breweries in 1985, only one was not making a lager, and it was the just newly founded brewery at EI in Amsterdam. All the other ones were making lager. The Dutch beer drinker only knew lager. In the 70s, some people start traveling to Belgium, discover Belgian Abbey beer. Some bar owners sneak crates of that stuff into the Netherlands, start selling it in their bar. And small by small steps, consumers discover there is actually more than lager. There is a band of squatters in Amsterdam, people who were in those days, you know, the anti-capitalist cowboys who decide they will now stop drinking this mass-produced lager by the big companies, and they will start bringing in also these small beers from Belgium and maybe even Germany. And those squatters are the initiators for Bier & Co., because Bier & Co. was then founded somewhere in the mid-80s. We don't know exactly when, because the oldest recorded document we have in the company are the minutes of a meeting where the main topic is that they reject the meetings of the previous meeting because of general drunkenness. That was like the atmosphere that you had within the company in the 1980s. But those squatters start to bring in beer from Belgium and Germany, and they finally found this company called Bier & Co. Bier & Co. mainly sold in those days to local bars, to local shops. It grew small steps by small steps. I joined it in 1998, and by that time we were still mainly distributing these beers in larger Amsterdam. So when Mr. Englet came to visit Bier & Co., he thought this is a potential partner, but not for all of the Netherlands, because these guys, these cowboys, they only sell in larger Amsterdam. So we actually made us accept the fact that the second company, Astijn, in the south of the Netherlands, was also going to be importing Mein Stefan. And then he dared the gamble of bringing the world's oldest beer to the neighboring country. It didn't sell easily. It's still a difficult topic, but in those days, turn of the millennium, there was still in the Netherlands a pretty strong anti-German sentiment, still dating back to World War II. When I was selling Mein Stefan in bars in Amsterdam in the year 2001, I would introduce this as being, you know, the most quality beer from Germany, from the world's oldest brewery, and speak a bit more about the fantastic character of the yeast and of the looks and of the flavor and the mouthfeel. And then the landlord would say, yeah, this is all interesting stuff, boy, but first I want to have the bicycle from my grandpa back. You guys can sort of like laugh about it, which I'm happy about. But, you know, this was seriously the sentiment in those days, that you had to convince people that not everything from Germany is bad. Mm-hmm. Thank God, yeah, in the year 2006, when we had the I'm not sure if it was the World Championships or the European Championships being held in Germany. It was the World Cup, right? And we had, again, a great edition from the game between the two rivals, Germany and the Netherlands. But there, the sentiment changed completely. And from the year 2006, I can really tell you, most of the Dutch have completely forgotten and forgiven about this whole World War II event. And that's where you really see Weinstephan start growing bigger and bigger and bigger, because the sentiment has gone. And by then, people have discovered they like to drink other beers than lager, and actually the refreshing qualities and the complex flavor components in Weinstephan make it a very, very interesting and very, very tasty beer to drink. And that's where the success story for Weinstephan in the Netherlands really starts taking off.
Now, the thing is, and this is what I think very interesting is, you told that the Netherlands where or is still a lager country, right? So, like most,
well, it has changed. You know, if you quickly to give you some information, when I started with Beer & Co., the market share was 99.5% lager and 0.5% non-lager. Mm-hmm. Currently, the year 2024, it is only 80% lager and 20% being non-lager. It's a massive change.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. But we see it, and this is what I wanted to bring in, because I can see what you said, that the diversity in the market when it comes to style and flavors were very low compared maybe to Bavaria or like other countries where you have a huge variety of styles and small-scale breweries. I would say Bavaria is a good example for it, from top fermented beers to lager beers, and from North Bavaria, South Bavaria, whatever. So the diversity here is, when it comes to how many breweries they are and on the styles, definitely bigger. But what I think about beer culture and what I think about beer country, beer nation, is also about how the people are onto beer, you know, even it's 99% lager beers that are drunk because that fits the taste very well. I mean, you could say the same about the Czech Republic, which was, I would say, 99.95% lager, you know. So, but they are also considered as one of the biggest beer countries in the world. Okay, they committed, I would say, culturally to one big style, which is the Czech style lagers. But still, they're drinking a lot of beer, and beer is part of their culture, so that they go out and then they would rather drink first a beer than a wine or a liquor or something like that. And this is also what I would say is in the Netherlands, that people are tending to drink as an alcoholic beverage more likely a beer than anything else. And I would say that also in Austria, in my home country, there we have a similar thing. So it's also mainly lager. So like non-lager beers are like maybe 5% of the market share in Austria. But it's a lager country, but it's a big beer country in my opinion, because the people, that's their cultural drink.
Yeah, but here is a couple of counter arguments. First of all, the way the Czechs drink lager, that is not drinking lager, that's a lifestyle. That is indeed, this is part of your daily routine. And, you know, I still love going to the Czech Republic and marvel at the sight that you can actually still see people there walking to a bar with a canister under their arm, having that filled with 1 or 2 liters of lager and go home again, because that's what they'd be drinking at home for lunch or just during work.
Yeah.
Go to any decent Czech beer bar, whether that is in the capital of Prague or in Pilsen or in any small village, there is a bar that is filled with people having heated debates and friendships made and lost on the same day over a couple of pints of lager. It is part of their blood. And the Netherlands, we drink lager because we drink beer. We're not proud of it. It is not ingrained in our daily routine. It is not part of our diet. It is not part of something we believe is inherently defining us. One of the things I love about going to Munich and go to Augustinerkeller is that whether it is Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, you walk in there, it's already jam-packed with young people, students drinking beer, but there's always going to be a couple of tables where little old ladies in their 70s, 80s, hat on, gloves on, very nicely dressed, are drinking a fucking half liter of lager there. That is beer culture. That is it is routine. It is part of your DNA.
Yeah.
This makes the difference with the Netherlands. We drink it, but you will have to search very hard for the Dutchman to say, I'm proud that Heineken is the second largest brewery in the world. You would have to search very long for people saying, I am proud of the fact that Grolsch Brewery still exists, even though it is owned by a bunch of Japanese these days, but the beer still has the flip-top bottle. Okay, you may find three or four in Enschede, and that's just about it. We Dutch are not proud of ourselves. We are not proud of our product. And that's why beer culture in the Netherlands is something inherently different than it is in the Czech Republic, in England, and particularly Germany. And of course, everyone knows this, but you cannot stress it enough. The story I still tell about why Weinstephan is so brilliant. Zillions of arguments, but one of the most compelling arguments is that there are three state-owned breweries in Germany, one in Baden-Württemberg, two in Bavaria, one being Hofbrauhaus in Munich, which is owned by the Ministry of Finance. And yes. Weinstephan is part of the Ministry of Education, Science, and Culture. It is, by definition, part of your DNA and of your culture. Bring that to the Dutch government and say Heineken should be state-owned and be made part of the Ministry of Culture. We don't even have a bloody Ministry of Culture.
Okay, when we start at that point, of course, then you're absolutely right. I also often refer to that, what beer means for the Bavarians or for the state of Bavaria. I always bring that up as an argument, is that the Waldseder's Brewery is owned by the state to preserve that kind of institution, and it's part of the Ministry of Science and Culture, because beer brewing is a science, but it also has something to do with culture, and that's the perfect spot for an institution like the Waldseder's Brewery, and that the state thinks that this has to be preserved to maintain it.
And we should not forget that it's also the Ministry of Art, and that's and brewing can be art too. I mean, we should not forget about that. It's not only science and culture; it's also art.
Art,
I mean,
yeah,
it's I'm learning something new every day. This can only add to my story. Beautiful, thanks, Anton.
I mean, I had to say it because our minister might be listening. So yeah. That's
yeah. Greatest secretary we ever had. Greetings.
By the way, I do agree with you. It's brewing is a form of art. And, you know, one of the things that continues to sometimes make me cry a little bit, how beautiful beer is in terms of bringing people together and forging friendships. The art of the brewer is something that always baffles me. You know, there are 300,000-400,000 different beers out there. They're all basically made with the four same ingredients, and they all have their own character. They all have their own flavor and look and aroma. And yes, not all beers are brewed by the Rheinheitsgebot, so they may contain more ingredients than just the basic four. But the basic idea that there is this endless variety possibility for brewers that just makes me sometimes be completely speechless.
One question I have now, we talked a lot about now the beer culture in the Netherlands and all around it, and that now nearly 20% of the market share are non-lagers. So I guess some of those share is also Weinstephan, and we grew a lot in the last couple of years. So if we look at the statistics from 10 years to now, it was a huge growth. And next to the perfect management and perfect sales of our why do you think the beer drinkers in the Netherlands like the taste of Weinstephan? Because, and just give me that one more minute, now as I'm responsible also for the sales in Austria, we are very well represented, especially in the skiing resorts and skiing areas like in Salzburg or in Tyrol, and especially in Tyrol there are a lot of favorite spots and resorts where a lot of Dutch people go there for skiing in the winter. And in this popular towns where a lot of Dutch people are going for skiing, there the Weinstephan sales is much, much, much higher than in a similar comparable town that is not that well visited by Dutch tourists.
I didn't know this.
I think there must be something.
I guess so. Well, let's not forget that Weinstephan, with its market introduction in the Netherlands in 1998, 1999, was actually still one of the forerunners in the import market, if you wish. So that gives you an advantage. And in the end of the day, Weinstephan originally was mainly well represented in the on-trade. It took us a long time to actually go to off-trade. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But brands with a good presence in on-trade have a much easier adoption level by consumers, period. It's like that. The tradition for going on winter sports has always been pretty huge in the Netherlands. And then if you find yourselves in après-ski parties with huge glasses of Weizen, that rings a bell. That is it's a very pleasant entertainment feature of your journey. That helps them, again, recognize the brand coming back to the Netherlands, seeing it in a bar. We couldn't really go to retail, by the way, because of the fact that the production capacity with Weinstephan has been restricted for quite a while. And export director Marcus Englert, but also your colleague and his successor, Johannes Weiss, told us, don't grow too fast, please, because we don't have the beer. So okay, we had to wait for a while. And I guess this is what you see in other markets as well. Ever since you've made some really nice alterations and expansions to the brewery, with a good increase of capacity, we now have way more opportunity to grow the brand and make it more present. And then when we were able to launch in Albert Heijn, the largest supermarket chain in the Netherlands, we originally, by the way, launched it in the 33-centiliter bottle because the Dutch supermarket shelves are not suited for the half-liter bottle size. It took us 3 years to make them realize that, you know, like you won't sell champagne that doesn't come from France, you sell Weizen that comes from Bavaria and that has to be in a half-liter size bottle. So change those shelves, please. And they did. And actually, from that moment on, you see the huge growth going with sometimes the support of the Vitus on the shelf or the Corbinian on the shelf or even the Dunkelweizen on the shelf. But the biggest selling beer at the moment, and I'm not sure if you already wanted to bring it up at this stage, but the biggest selling beer this moment in retail is actually the alcoholfreies Hefeweizen.
Yeah.
And that is because, in the end of the day, even the Dutch, you know, we are the cheapest bastards on earth, but we do realize quality and affordability when we come across it. And there just are no better alcohol-free beers on the market than the German alcohol-free Weizens.
Yeah. Oh, we're glad to hear that. And we see that in other markets too, where we're going to introducing the non-alcoholic. So especially non-alcoholic wheat beer, it's working very, very well. But I strongly support strongly agree to your thing what you told about that you built the brand in the on-trade, you know.
Let me quickly interrupt you again here, because this is one of the most beautiful anecdotes there is. When the first really big on-trade customer we made was in The Hague, and it was 2002. The bar was called the Zwarte Ruiter, and it is located on Market Square in Den Haag. I personally installed the tapping equipment there, and then we were finally ready to test the tap installation. It was a spring day. It was a Wednesday afternoon. It was 4 o'clock. It was 21 degrees, and the waiter walks out with this serving tray with 8 Stefani glasses filled to the brim with fresh Weinstephan. When he walked across that terrace, you could hear snap, 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 snap. All those necks were spinning. What the fuck is that? We want that. don't underestimate how important this little marketing tool of your phenomenal Stefani glass is, and particularly for people who've never really seen it. The first time you see a waiter carrying a tray of those full Stefani glasses with the golden yellow beer in it and the snow white foam on it, that just makes you want to hoist the black flag, spit in your hand, and jump that boy.
I mean, 100%. I mean, that's. I remember one of my first conversations with Buzz. He was telling me that they just ordered, loads of glasses, because that was the strategy to go to be visible in the market with the glasses on the on-trade.
Absolutely. And then particularly this conversation is really going from A to Z in seconds. our current marketing campaign, Dat Klinkt Goed, is actually also based on the phenomenal glass, because, you know, this particular tradition of toasting each other with a full glass of beer, particularly with this classic Weizen glass, this beautiful Stefani, the thick foot, if you clang those together, that sounds good. Das klingt gut. And you know, even that is an intrinsic part of at least our marketing strategy. That what has always been in the hidden, if you wish, in the essence of the marketing tools that Weinsteffen already had. But if you can bring that to the customer and say, this is how you really enjoy life with your friends or with even total strangers, but you toast each other with a Weinsteffen glass, that klingt goed. That makes your life be at total tops.
I see also very, very often that this identification tools like a glassware or how to, you know, handle the beer, also like serve it with the foamy hat, with the foam crown and stuff like that, that all those rituals and all those iconic things around a beer or a brand are very, very important for the sales, and that people go back to it and continuously consume it. But that's just one part of the story. The other part is the quality, of course. And sure. When it comes to the quality, we are very proud that we are working very close with the university to maintain the quality, that our brewers and brewmasters are working hard every day to keep that up. And that's why we are handing in our beers regularly to the big beer competitions in the world, where you are also a judge there. So maybe some of our listeners are not so familiar with that situation, even if we can make now a little turn in the topic about that part of your job, representing your company, but also your knowledge about beer at these beer competitions. So can you walk us a little bit through that, how hard it at some point it is to get maybe to a final or in the end to a medal at those competitions, or how this is looking behind the
look behind the scenes?
Yes.
Well, I think it is very important first to stress there are two types of competitions in the beer world. And while it is important, that will become apparent later. There are competitions that are run according to the Olympic thought. So in a category, you can only have one gold winner, one silver winner, one bronze winner. Mm. And there are competitions that are shaped more like wine concourses. They say, okay, if you score out of 100 over 95, you get a gold medal. And if you score over 90, you get a silver medal. But it means that within the same category, actually more beers than one can get this gold or silver or bronze medal. Personally, I believe the Olympic version is the best version.
Yeah, because it's much more understandable for people who are not familiar with that to understand, oh, that's good, because it's, made this one medal out of so many others.
You can make arguments for both cases. I think for the latter version, for the concourse model, you can say, well, all of these beers are definitely worth trying. They are all good.
That's true.
But the Olympic medal says this is actually really, really representing a world-class product within its category. And we, the jury of this day, of this competition, considered it the best beer on the table. There's always the complaint from consumers saying, but how can you say it is the best beer in the world? Not all of the beers were participating. No, of course not. But then again, that's the same thing with the Olympics. there may be a winner of the marathon. That doesn't mean that there is not a faster Ethiopian somewhere in Africa that we don't know about. And there's never the guarantee that you know if it is really the world's best. Thing is, if you don't participate, you can't win.
Yes.
So it is always only about the breweries who are brave enough to participate with the risk of not being awarded the medal.
Yeah, avoiding the competition in the first place is the first mistake you can make.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is, by the way, the reason why no competition will ever make public participating breweries, because of the risk that people say, ah, you are Wein Stefan, you participated with your beer in the competition, you didn't get a medal, ha, 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 ha. That risk is there. So that's why that is not being disclosed who is participating. But contrary, if you do win a medal, it means you can go out to the world and say, my beer has been tasted by a panel of experts and it got an award. So it is definitely world-class and definitely worthwhile to try. Now, you do also need to take into account that it is being tasted by humans. We are not machines. So even though I have 15 years of tasting experience as a beer judge, but it still doesn't mean that I am always unbiased. If I sleep poorly the night before judging, I will definitely judge differently than if I had slept like a baby. If the weather is depressing, I will definitely, however much as I would want it to be differently, but I know that I will rate differently. I'm not a machine. Plus, the beers on the table are not always the same. Even though Wein Stefan has the highest quality standard in the world, there are differences between batches. There are differences between batches in a year, but even bigger differences between batches over various years, because raw materials change and the brewers do everything they can to come as close to their desired piece as they or standard as they want to come, and the differences may be only really small, but there are always differences. So in the end of the day, winning a medal is awesome, is huge, is beautiful, but it is still a picture of that day, of that particular competition only. Having said that, that is what it is. And then if you are able to walk away with a gold, a silver, or a bronze medal in the Australian Beer Awards or at the World Beer Cup or at European Beer Star or at Brussels Beer Challenge, those are, in my book, the four most important beer competitions in the world, because they use the Olympic method and because they use panels of objective experts, then you can truly say you are a great brewery. Ha, that's a coincidence. Wein Stefan has been winning awards at all these festivals. Ha ha.
Oh no.
not the Brussels Beer Challenge. We didn't hand it in there for quite some time, some beer, but the other three are standards. So like World Beer Cup, European Beer Star, and the Australian Beer Awards are standards. And lucky enough, we have won at the last recent competitions continuously medals, and it, at some point really it doesn't matter so much if it's for us a gold, silver, or bronze medal. We are very happy if we get one, because it means the continuously from year to year being like in the top three doesn't matter. And like you said, the judges could have a good day or a bad day or whatever, or you know, or the batch was not like the 100% on point. It could happen a lot, like you mentioned, but still being in the top three over years at those competitions means a lot to us.
That is absolutely a very important addition, and I was going to get there myself if I was not needing so much time to get to my point. Sorry about that. But you are right, because it means continuation, continuous quality, and that is in the end of the day way more important than winning a gold medal once and then never being heard of again. That still means the beer at that day was in tip-top shape and the best in competition.
Yeah.
But winning consistently over the years in different beer competitions, that really makes you a standout beer. Because here, to finally answer your first question, the people who judge are trained to be objective. You only know the category that you will be tasting, and then it may vary per competition what the parameters are that the organizers give to score at. So if you take this category of Hefeweizen, then they will give you a bandwidth of the color. It may be from this light to this dark, but if it is outside of that bracket, then you should not award points for the color. The same goes for aroma, the same goes for flavor, the same goes for mouthfeel. And to maybe take another example, if you are judging the lager competition and you get a very dark beer presented to you, you don't even have to taste it. It could be tasting fantastic, but it doesn't match the expectation of the parameters, and that's what you score at.
Rick, let me ask you one last question, because then we're running out of time, unfortunately. But let me ask you one last question. That's if a random person comes to the Netherlands and wants to drink Weinstephaner, do you have a favorite location where to go to?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. 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 There are three locations I would strongly recommend. First of all, it's my own clubhouse, Bierproeflokaal in de Wildeman in Amsterdam. One of the oldest and definitely most respected beer bars in the Netherlands. And by saying it is my clubhouse, I do mean that I'm probably spending more time there than at my own home. These guys have mastered the art of tapping a Weinstephan over the past 20 years that they have been serving it on draft, and they've got a good selection of the bottles as well. So you can't come to the Netherlands to drink Weinstephan without going to de Wildeman. But you should also, on your way in or out, get out of the train in Zwolle and go to In de Buurt, In the Neighborhood, very nice local beer bar with a great selection in the center of Zwolle, underneath that famous church tower that looks like a pepper and salt bottle on your table. Not only do they serve the Weinstephan Hefeweizen there out of the classic ceramic tap, but they also do Weinstephan Pilsner as their house beer.
Nice.
So that is definitely a reason to go there. And go to Den Bosch, go to Paaltje, and drink a fantastically tapped Weinstephan there.
Perfect. What would you eat to it? Bitterballen?
That is a great question. unfortunately, both de Wildeman in de Buurt and Paaltje don't serve bitterballen. Oh. But bitterballen, the typical Dutch fine dining snack, fits everything. So surely you could do it. My personal favorite still is, and you can't order it because no bar actually serves it, but Jong Go cheese. Jong Go cheese together with Weinstephan, that is by far my favorite. Or, and this is an interesting one, not sure if the listeners will know this, satay. You know, those grilled skewers. Yeah, they can be chicken. If they're really good, then they are pork meat.
Oh,
Or you can use goat. You can basically also use everything. But it is really, the secret is about the peanut sauce. Mm-hmm. Because the soft and spicy combination and the texture of that sauce, particularly if you combine it with the pork version of the meat skewer, with the slightly sweet flavor, it basically brings everything together in the dish that you also find essentially, without the spice, of course, in the Hefeweizen. And it's a phenomenal experience to enjoy those.
I not had that. I will definitely go with that.
I'll make sure next time you're here, I'll make you bathe in beer and satay.
Yeah,
I guess so. Then, Rick, I just want
to... Not so enthusiastic.
No, I will. I was just thinking about it the whole time. I was like, did I have it? And I was like, nah.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
I really go with it and for it. And especially then, one more thing, which is very, very important, that thank you for all your work you have done the past 25 years for beer drinkers in the Netherlands, but also for us as a friend and as an ambassador for our products and our beer and for our brand. We really appreciate it. And it's absolutely fantastic hanging out with you and drinking beer and exchanging stories and knowledge about the beer. I guess much more will come And I can't wait to see you next time in person.
Really, much more will come. And thank you so much for the kind words. But the warmth that you express in your words is still not even at 30% of the warmth and the love and the thanks and the gratitude that we feel towards you guys from Freising, our family in Freising. We're truly honored to still be working with you guys. Pretty soon we will be celebrating our 25th anniversary of working together. Reason for a party, I would say. And we truly hope to be seeing you guys soon in the market again to get some more customers going and slowly work our way to the year 2040 when we will paint the Netherlands blue and white and we'll go offline.
That sounds perfect.
Absolutely awesome.
Thank you so much, Rick, for your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for being here on the show.
Thanks, guys. Stay safe. Cheers.
You too. Cheers.
Bye-bye.